I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times.
This breaking story has just come in. State police in Harrisburg have been called to the 3 Mile nuclear plant about 10 miles southeast of Harrisburg, where plant officials have called a general emergency. State police in Harrisburg have been called to the 3 Mile nuclear plant about 10 miles southeast of Harrisburg, where plant officials have called a general emergency. A spokesman for the state police in Harrisburg says he's not sure what is meant by a general emergency, but that the police have been called in to direct traffic away from the nuclear power plant.
That was KYW News Radio at 4 a.m. on March 28, 1979, announcing an emergency at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania. One of their reactors was overheating, eventually leading to a partial meltdown, panic, and confusion among the public. 2 days later, then-Governor Richard Thornburg made this announcement.
Based on advice of the chairman of the NRC, I am advising pregnant women and preschool-aged children to leave the area within a 5-mile radius of the 3 Mile Island facility until further notice.
Today, on the 40th anniversary of the 3 Mile Island accident, we asked Tom Ferrick to tell us what it was like to cover the accident for the Philadelphia Inquirer, that won a Pulitzer Prize for its reporting of TMI. Tom is now an independent reporter, editor, and blogger. You can check out his website, pa2018.org, Facing the Future, about Pennsylvania. And Tom Ferrick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
So where were you when you heard the news of an accident at TMI?
I was in Harrisburg, and we were working. I was in the Harrisburg Bureau, and I was working in the bureaus in the Capitol. And I came in that morning of the accident. My boss, Bill Eckenbarger, said, there's been an incident at 3 Mile Island. And I said, where's 3 Mile Island?
Even though it was just 10 miles away.
I had no idea. Although, you used to see the cooling towers. And he said, the lieutenant governor is going to hold a briefing in 10 minutes. So I went up to the press room and heard Bill Scranton say, basically, that there had been an incident, that the utility says it's under control. And further, in response to questioning, he doesn't expect any serious problems. And that in response to questioning, he said no radiation had been released into the air. Well, it turns out they were all lies. It wasn't because Bill was lying. It was because the utility company, which was General Public Utility and MedEd, misled government officials.
Withholding information? Or did they know what was happening at TMI?
By that time, we're talking 10 o'clock in the morning, they knew what was happening, and they probably knew enough to be scared as hell. But they didn't want to create alarm, and they thought they could bring it under control. I will tell you this, that Dick Thornburg was the governor, and
yes.
Dick's a former prosecutor. And it's not a good idea to lie to prosecutors, as you know. And when they found out that they were being misled, they were furious in the Thornburg administration. And he immediately called the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then the next time I went upstairs was at 9 o'clock at night.
Wednesday,
to have a briefing with the specialist that the NRC had brought up. So we go up to the governor's press room, and there's the governor, there's the lieutenant governor, there's a whole bunch of people wearing blue suits, and there's three guys, and there were guys, wearing khakis, and had hard hats tucked under their arm. And the person who was covering this down in Philly was Susan Stranahan, who luckily for me is an expert on nuclear power. I knew nothing about nuclear power.
Absolutely nothing?
Nothing. Well, it's nuclear. That's all I knew.
Right.
And I said before I went up, I said, do you want me to ask any question? And she said, yes. Ask them if there's been any damage to the cladding.
So did you know what cladding was?
No, I had no idea. Could have been plaid, for all I knew. So I went up, and that was a question I asked. And the guy from the NRC leaned into the mic and said, yes, there is evidence of damage. So I went downstairs. I was feeding my notes in. And I said, oh, I asked that question about cladding. They said, yes, there has been damage to the cladding. And at the other end of the line, there was this sharp intake of breath by Susan that was basically the nonverbal equivalent of, oh, my God. Because what cladding is the zirconium metal that surrounds the rods to protect. And if it was melting off, that means the rods were exposed. They shouldn't be exposed to the air. And when they're exposed to the air, they just generate more and more and more heat. I mean, we're talking several thousand degrees Fahrenheit. And they melt metal and they create gases. And it is the beginning of a meltdown,
right,
is what it is. And that's what was happening. And she knew that, and I knew that then, and the coverage in the paper reflected it the next day because she could look forward and say, this is a serious situation, stuff that the people weren't telling us at the time.
Now, how soon did you get to Three Mile Island to actually see what was going on?
Well, I really couldn't see anything because everything that was going on was in a containment building that if you got near it would kill you in 30 seconds. But by the time Sunday came, the situation was sufficiently under control that the president of the United States came to visit to reassure people.
Jimmy Carter, right.
And remember that Jimmy Carter was a nuclear physicist. I mean, he was a nuclear engineer. And so he and Rosalynn flew up and took a tour of the control room. I don't know, maybe Rosalynn had nothing to do that day. He said, let's go up and visit TMI. And I was a pool reporter for local reporters. And what happened was is that it was basically a media show because he went through and pointed at things and they pointed at things and I wrote it all down and he came out and said, I'm confident that these people can take care of this problem and, you know, we think things to calm a public that was growing increasingly hysterical. Mm-hmm. He also dispatched wisely a guy named Harold Denton, who was sort of the shambolic southern nuclear engineer, who had a very calm demeanor and had the ability to explain things to people in a very good way. I will tell you that it didn't take long in talking about the nuclear plant to go right into the weeds of jargon.
Sure.
And you could get totally lost.
Sure.
In reality, you could say, I mean, a nuclear plant, it's very simple. It's a giant tea kettle. They boil water. The water produces steam. They pressurize it. They send it to a steam generator, and it produces electricity. But the complications involved with that, as you can imagine, are pretty big.
Well, I was looking at some photos yesterday from Three Mile Island, and there's one of President Carter, First Lady Rosalynn Carter, and others, as you said, touring the facility, looking at all the dials and knobs.
Yeah.
We are talking, you know, technology of 40 years ago.
Right.
And they have wrapped around their feet what looks like baggies of some sort.
This is one of the sort of surrealistic moments.
I couldn't understand.
Yeah, in order to go in a plant, you had to have on a dosimeter, which makes sense, which reads the amount. And you had to put on these, and I did too, these sort of white plastic / paper booties that went calf length. And I guess the concept was, once you wear these, you're perfectly safe. We don't want any random radiation to hit you. And but, of course, if that plant had gone, the booties would not have helped anybody.
No, kind of like duck and cover, right?
Yeah, yeah. And the thing was, is that if I were the president's handlers, I would have never let him put on plastic booties. It made him look like a character, you know, out of some sort of child's program. But he did it, and he assured the people because I think by then, by Sunday, which is now 4 days after the accident, the situation had stabilized. The big concern was on Friday when they discovered that, again, nuclear, it boils. I mean, it heats up, and among the things it's created is heat and gas. And there were hydrogen bubbles within the reactor. And the concern was that the bubble would explode. And if it exploded, it could pierce the containment building. And if that happened, the meltdown would hasten. And plumes of radioactivity would go how far, carried by the wind. That's exactly what happened at Chernobyl, by the way, in 1986,
right.
Except they didn't have a containment building. The Soviets found a way to save money on that. And that went all over that territory. And there were 330,000 people who lost their homes.
Yeah.
And many who lost their lives because the kids had thyroid cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a very dangerous situation. But eventually, on Thursday night, I remember, someone in the governor's office called up me and Bill Eckenbarger, and we knew him. And he said,
"The Inquirer."
Yeah, the Inquirer. And he worked for the governor. And he said, "No matter what anybody tells you or what you hear, this is a serious situation, and we don't know what's going to happen. We really don't." And he said, "If I were you, I would get a plan of evacuation
for yourself personally."
Yeah. So we called up our boss, John Carroll. May he rest in peace. Our boss at the time, Metropolitan Editor, and we said, "John, we just got a call from the governor's office." And they said, "This thing could blow." And he said, "Wow." He says, "Well, that happens," because we had a lot of reporters then. We got to get reporters out at the edge of the fleeing crowd and catch them. And then he said, "We need somebody Tom, when the governor gets on that her helicopter, you be the last person on it. And then he said, we're going to need someone there. And I said, there? He said, yeah, at the plant. And I said, John, the plant may blow. And he said, well, of course, it would have to be a volunteer.
Well, let me read an email we've got from Don, not unrelated to what you just said there, Tom. He said, I was a manager of an apartment complex. The municipality slipped evacuation route flyers under our doors, and the apartment owner asked me to stay in Hershey as protection against looting of the apartments. Then Don adds, he left. Well, I mean, we laugh now.
I know.
But this was a scary time.
Oh, it was a very scary time. And I think what happened was is that Dick Thornburgh, I sort of fault him for this in a way. He did not order an evacuation and got a lot of credit for that. But there was de facto evacuation. Anybody who could afford to left. And if you went to Camp Hill, which was a fairly prosperous suburb of Harrisburg, at 6 o'clock at night, it was completely empty because all the people had fled.
Wow. Who and they had the wherewithal, I guess,
yeah,
to go somewhere.
Yeah, if you were poor or if you're in a nursing home or if you were in a prison, you couldn't flee. So those people were lucky nothing happened.
We're almost about on our first break here. How much did you have a chance to talk to residents living around TMI at the time?
I actually was the leg man in charge of the government end.
Right.
So I didn't. We did send a reporter down to Lancaster County to talk to the Amish. I think it was Bill Eichenberger, I forget. And they said, are you surprised at this accident? And they said, no. He says, this is exactly what happens with you people who are enraptured by the modern. You know, you're paying the price of that. And, of course, they were right. Of course, we didn't want to have beards and horses, but...
Very interesting comment there. Let me read some more comments from our listeners. And let me just also add that you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Memories of 3 Mile Island 40 years ago today, the beginning of a crisis that was averted, but nonetheless raising a whole host of questions about nuclear energy. An email from Jim says, I was with my wife in labor and was listening to news reports. I occasionally glanced out the window, expecting to see a ghastly green glow appear at any moment. We didn't see that.
No.
An email from Janet. I was a college student about 15 miles from TMI. I decided to return home to South Jersey for the weekend. Little did I know that my weekend visit would stretch to 10 days after the college announced what the students came to refer to as radiation vacation. Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Tom Farrick. He's now an independent reporter, editor, and blogger, and he was one of the Philadelphia Inquirer team of reporters covering the 3 Mile Island accident. The Inquirer received a Pulitzer Prize for its reporting. And stay with us much more after this very short break. And I should add, coming up, we'll be talking about the legacy of TMI, Chernobyl, and Fukushima, the growing threat of climate change, and how we should think about the role and risks of nuclear energy. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we are marking the 40th anniversary of 3 Mile Island. Here's ABC's news correspondent Tom Jarrell reporting from Harrisburg on March 30th, 1979.
There is no imminent danger. That's the official advice tonight, but many people aren't buying it. Thousands have packed their luggage and they've left. Banks reports many withdrawals. Telephone lines have been busy. Outdoor activities like the horse races have been canceled. People are afraid of what they can't see, radiation. And they've heard so much contradictory technical jargon from officials that the first casualty of this accident may have been trust.
Tom Farrick, staying with us for the next 5 minutes or so. What do you think, Tom? What are the lessons of TMI?
That's a blue sky question.
It is a blue sky question, but you were there.
And to a certain degree, we had answers. It basically stopped the nuclear power industry in its tracks for 30 years, number one, both because of costs associated with, you know, upgrading the plants so that they could meet it. And secondly, it was sort of, well, let me put it this way. I've spent my whole career covering things that never should have happened. And we had been assured time and again that they wouldn't happen. We were told that nuclear power was safe. We were told that nuclear power was a cheap, inefficient, and clean way to produce energy. And the answer to that, and it was until it wasn't. And when it's not, it has drastic consequences, as they found at Fukushima, as they found at Chernobyl. And I don't think there's anybody, anywhere, even though the design of the plants have changed, that can say it won't happen again.
Mm. Well, we're going to deal with that question with our two guests who are waiting in the wings. Let me read a couple of more emails. And we did send out a couple of notices to our listeners saying, what are your memories of TMI? Here's one from Andrew. 2 weeks before TMI, I was watching the China Syndrome in a now famous exchange in the movie. The nuclear plant engineer says that such a nuclear meltdown would contaminate, quote, an area the size of Pennsylvania. And I must add to that I, too, remember watching the China Syndrome as all of this was going on as well. An email from Mary Beth. My high school evacuated all the students. Looking back now, it seems silly to have moved students 10 to 15 miles for quote unquote safety. If something had really happened, I don't think 10 to 15 miles would have made a difference. Here's an email from Eric. After TMI, nuclear power became a pariah in the United States. I wouldn't give up on nuclear power yet, but I would look to countries like France that have successful programs and going on from there. Any final questions do you have, Tom, that were never answered 40 years ago about TMI?
I think we know now precisely what happened. And it was sort of a combination of human error, mechanical error, compounded by more human error, mechanical error. So it was a machinery that was designed to be flawless. But A was not flawless, and the people who were operating it couldn't be flawless either. And I just don't know how you engineer that out, regardless of whether it's in France or anywhere. You're always going to have the risk, I mean, and the risk that there will be an accident with fairly serious consequences for people's health.
And you lived near Harrisburg, which was about, at that time, which was about little less than 10 miles
from
TMI.
Yeah, I found out very quickly. It was like 9.8 miles. And my wife and I had just bought our first house at the princely sum of $44,500 at 10% interest rate in those days.
Yep.
And we thought we'd end up with a property with a half-life of 500 years. Mm. But that didn't happen. So we were lucky. And we never fled. We were there covering. We were working. We had to stay there. We would have left if we hadn't stayed there.
Yeah, if you weren't covering it for
We weren't covering it for, you know, as a reporter.
Well, I'm glad you covered it. I'm glad you survived it.
And I'm glad still here.
And I'm glad you're still here, Tom. And I'm glad you joined us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And again, Tom Farrick, part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team of reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer, covering TMI, Three Mile Island, 40 years ago. He's now an independent reporter, editor, and blogger. In fact, you can check out his website, pa2018.org, Facing the Future. And that is news all about Pennsylvania. Tom, thanks very much for joining us on Radio Times. Well, we are marking the 40th anniversary of TMI today, the partial meltdown of one of the facility's reactors that remains the worst nuclear power plant accident in U.S. history. About 20% of the country's electricity is generated by nuclear power today. While there is also mistrust of the industry and the technology, due in part to TMI, Chernobyl, and more recently, the accident at Fukushima. But with the growing threat of climate change, there are calls to invest in nuclear power as a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and save the planet. So today on Radio Time, should we rely more on nuclear energy, or do the safety concerns override the carbon-free benefits? And we have two guests who have joined us. Edwin Lyman is a senior scientist with Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's acting director of the Nuclear Safety Project. He's a physicist and co-author of Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Edwin Lyman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Joshua Goldstein, and he's a professor emeritus of international relations at American University, co-author of a new book called A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Joshua Goldstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be with you.
Since we were talking about Three Mile Island, we are here in Pennsylvania. It's the 40th anniversary. From each of you, and I'll start with you, Edwin Lyman, just your quick thoughts. What do you think that the message, the lesson of TMI is for us today? Edwin?
Sure. Well, the lesson of TMI is, as Mr. Farrick so well put it, that nuclear technology is not infallible, that it has the potential for serious consequences, and that complacency is the worst enemy of nuclear power. So the lessons really have to be examining what happened at TMI, as has been done, and taking all the messages from it about how nuclear safety and security can be improved in the future, and again, fighting complacency. The problem is that we have not actually learned all the lessons of TMI, and that's what concerns us.
Joshua Goldstein, what do you think the legacy, the lessons of TMI are for us today?
I don't think complacency is the worst enemy of nuclear power. I think fear is. And there was so much fear around this accident that didn't actually cause that much harm, but everybody was afraid that it would, that, as Tom said, it stopped nuclear power in its tracks for 30 years. And because of that, we kept burning coal in the United States instead of nuclear power. And something like a million Americans have died because we kept burning coal, from cancer, from emphysema, from asthma, and sickened 10 times that many. In Pennsylvania alone, coal is still killing thousands of people every year. So you can't look at nuclear power in terms of risk versus no risk. It has to be the risk of nuclear power versus other ways that we generate power, and I don't think we've learned that lesson.
Well, Joshua, let me just do a quick follow-up. You say thousands of people in Pennsylvania are dying because of coal. Thousands of people?
Yes, almost 4,000 people. An MIT study parsed this out very carefully a few years ago. And that's in addition to coal dumping carbon into the atmosphere, which methane gas also does. Methane's much safer, except occasionally when it blows up. But nuclear power has killed approximately zero people in 60 years. Now, in 1979, I was against nuclear power. I didn't like it. And we all had good reason to distrust it because it was new. We didn't know if it was safe. And also, we didn't know about climate change then. So now we know that we have a desperate problem, challenge with climate change to get rid of the fossil fuels by mid-century. And if you do the math, nothing but nuclear power can really scale up that fast. But we also know that it's safe now. It's been 60 years. That Three Mile Island was the only really serious accident, and it either killed nobody or very close to nobody, depending how you want to parse the numbers. And we also know that there's countries and regions that have successfully gotten rid of the carbon emissions on their electric grids, countries like Sweden and France. And every country that's done that, it's either hydropower, which can't be scaled up much because it's already, the good spots are already dammed, or it's nuclear power. You can see this for yourself on a website called electricitymap.org. You can actually track Pennsylvania's electricity generation, see where it comes from, see how dirty it is, how much carbon emissions going in. But the clean countries, Sweden, France, Ontario province, they're doing it with nuclear power. It's so concentrated that it can scale up really fast. France took fossil fuels off the grid in 15 years and replaced them with nuclear power. And that's what we need for climate change, something that can scale up really fast, carbon-free, proven safe, and can get us there by mid-century to actually get the fossil fuels
up. Sure. And let me get Edwin Lyman back in on the conversation. I mean, I think we can all agree that we are dealing with a threat of climate change, so we're not debating that. The question is nuclear, which is essentially carbon-free, is that a solution to climate change? How do you see that, Edwin?
Yes, well, it certainly is an option for helping to mitigate climate change in theory because it is a low-carbon source of electricity. But I do take issue with Professor Goldstein's approach and the statistics that he's bandying about. I don't think that diminishing or belittling the potential consequences of nuclear power accidents, terrorist attacks, nuclear proliferation, or waste disposal is the right way to get at this problem. Unless you confront the actual issues in a serious way, which are not the opposition of the anti-nuclear industry, but primarily the question of economics today, which is has been the biggest obstacle to nuclear power expansion. Unless you deal with those issues in a realistic way, you're just bandying about talking points and not actually getting to the root of it.
Well, let me pick up on that. My understanding in doing some homework for the program is that, at least as it stands now, and certainly looking at TMI and some of these other plants both in Pennsylvania and across the United States, is there isn't much profit in nuclear energy. Is that what you're referring to, Edwin Lyman?
Yes, and the profitability is really a factor of local electricity markets and a whole bunch of different factors. But the general issue is that fossil fuel generation right now is very cheap, and even nuclear plants that have operated for many years and paid off their capital cost may not be able to operate and compete with fossil fuels in those markets where it must compete. So that's one challenge.
Hold on one second, but Joshua. Let me just give Edwin a chance to finish that sentence. No, go ahead.
But the response of the industry, unfortunately, is to blame the regulator, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and to press for weakening of safety and security regulations in an attempt to cut costs. And that would be really a counterproductive approach, because it's in no one's interest to see another Three Mile Island or another Fukushima. It's not going to help the industry. In fact, it could well take it off the table.
No.
And we need to understand the consequences of those accidents, and I can, I'd like to the opportunity
sure.
to respond.
Okay. Absolutely. And let me go back to you, Joshua Goldstein, just to give you a chance to respond. Are you concerned about cutting costs and security safety at nuclear power plants?
I'm not that concerned about security and safety. I'm very concerned about the costs, because if nuclear power can't be brought down in cost, then it's not going to be able to outcompete fossil fuels. But if you ask why is gas and coal so cheap today, a lot of it is that we're not counting some of the costs of generating in that way. All those thousands of people, 3,800 people a year dying from coal in Pennsylvania, that's not charged on the coal price. If you put the health consequences onto the price of fossil fuels, you'd be paying about double the amount per kilowatt hour that we are now. And then also, we're not charging for dumping carbon into the atmosphere. You know, if you dump your garbage at the dump, you have to pay a fee, or you pay a sewer tax from your house. But fossil generators just dump CO2 into the atmosphere, cause global warming, and there's no charge for it at all. So if there were a way to charge for that, then nuclear power plants would be more competitive. And that's exactly what the Pennsylvania legislature is looking at. I'd like to quote Ed Lyman's own organization, the Union of Concerned Scientists, quote, "New public policies are needed to properly value low carbon energy and prevent the replacement of nuclear plants with large quantities of natural gas." So that's exactly what you're talking about right now in Pennsylvania. And Mr. Lyman's own organization thinks that's a bad idea to replace nuclear plants with natural gas.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Joshua Goldstein, Edwin Lyman, and we are talking about the pros and cons of nuclear power. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Do you want to respond to that, Edwin Lyman? And I do want to move off the cost and get into some other ways of thinking about nuclear power and also things like renewables. But respond, if you could, to what Joshua Goldstein just said.
Yes, and I think quoting UCS's report out of context has been a big problem. UCS has never been opposed to nuclear power, but we're not supporters either. We take a pragmatic approach, and that report actually recommends or describes a full set of conditions that we think have to be met before it would be appropriate for any state to provide support for nuclear power. And one of those criteria is that it needs to meet safety and security standards. The report and recommendations have to be considered in that context. And my understanding is that the current legislation in Pennsylvania doesn't meet the criteria that my organization has set out.
Joshua Goldstein, let me move beyond Pennsylvania. And you mentioned Sweden, and you write a lot about Sweden in your book and what Sweden did incorporating nuclear power as part of a whole sort of menu of approaches to how to both provide reliable energy to the residents, but also to deal with this issue of climate change. Can you speak to what Sweden did?
Sweden had hydroelectric power. It's still about 40% of their grid. And instead of putting fossil fuel on as their energy use was growing several decades ago, they rolled out nuclear power. It's the fastest addition of clean energy to a grid anywhere in the world in history. But right behind it, the next eight fastest cases are also all cases of nuclear rollout. that's why it's so good for our climate situation where we need clean energy fast. They also put in place a carbon price, carbon tax, which has encouraged changes across the economy to reduce carbon emissions. But when they just rolled out the nuclear power, that one step dropped carbon emissions by half, just like that. And the economy kept growing by 50% during that time. So they're actually using more electricity, but it's cleaner electricity. And it's not an unpleasant place to live, Sweden. It's not like they're making terrible sacrifices to lower their emissions. They're just getting their energy cleaner.
Edwin Lyman, about a minute before our break here, but is that a model that the United States could look at?
I'm not familiar enough with the actual history of the Swedish program to comment, but I would want to talk about this notion that nuclear power is so scalable. I mean, in practice, in most places, it is not proven to be, and certainly in recent years, nuclear energy has stagnated. In the United States, there were attempts. There was a proposed nuclear renaissance more than 10 years ago where Congress did provide the substantial opportunities for public support in nuclear power, and that renaissance just fizzled out. So so obviously something's not working, and nuclear power, if it's actually going to be deployed rapidly and at a large scale, someone needs to come up with a concrete financial proposal on how that actually happens. And I've heard a lot of very vague comments about how nuclear power can be scaled up, but it has not occurred in practice. And part of the reason is that fundamental cost.
Mm. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about nuclear power, nuclear energy, with Edwin Lyman, pros and cons of, and Joshua Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're doing several things this hour. First of all, marking the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. In fact, tonight at 11 o'clock on TV 12, you can see a documentary titled Meltdown at TMI 40 Years Later. We're also talking about, with the growing threat of climate change, is nuclear energy an option to reduce greenhouse gases? Can the industry and the technology be trusted? Talking with Edwin Lyman. He's a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, co-author of a book called Fukushima. Joshua Goldstein, co-author of a book called A Bright Future, touting the benefits of nuclear energy. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Evan Lyman, let me go back to you. And I hear your reluctance about nuclear energy, your concern about the costs and things like safety, but we are being threatened by climate change, and the clock is ticking, as I understand it, from everyone that has taken a serious look at the situation that we are in today. If not nuclear, then can we use efficiency? Can we use renewables? Can we stop eating meat? Can we, you know, make sure our buildings are efficient when it comes to energy? Is that enough to address the crisis that we're in?
Well, I'll start out by saying that my expertise is not renewable energy, so I defer that to some of my colleagues. But I would like to address the larger issue. And again, nuclear power is one of a suite of options, some of which are well-developed and others which aren't. But partly it's a societal decision where to put the resources to solve the challenges of implementing any non- or low-carbon technology on a large scale. So, for instance, the nuclear power advocates often talk about the intermittency of wind and solar as a flaw that nuclear can avoid, but there are technological challenges that could help to overcome those issues, and those are comparable technological challenges to making nuclear power safe and secure enough and affordable enough, in my view, that it could also be a large-scale source. So you have trade-offs, and for instance, on the issue of the number of deaths caused by coal, I'd have to look at the underlying study, mm-hmm. but to the extent that those deaths are estimates based on particulate emissions and other emissions from coal-fired plants. The option, of course, is not there's always the option to apply more filters on coal plants to reduce those emissions. That's, again, a question of cost. So you're not, you need to compare, you need to understand what all the options are, what their costs are, and benefits, and then apply, a rational process.
Well, Joshua Goldstein, let me go back to you and essentially put the same question, which is for people, and I see from some comments I have here, people are, as you mentioned, afraid of nuclear energy. But can we get to reliable sources of energy to essentially feed a world that demands more energy through renewables?
No, you can't get there through renewables. And it's wrong to say that the challenges are comparable. We don't have any battery technology anywhere in sight that can store energy for a whole city for weeks at a time when the sun is not shining or the wind isn't blowing. And it can go long periods like that. So what do you do in those periods? The answer is you use fossil fuels. The renewables always have gone with fossil fuels, especially natural gas. And that's what will replace the Three Mile Island if you shut it down in Pennsylvania. The Citizens Against Nuclear Bailouts in Pennsylvania is actually mostly the oil and gas company. So they benefit from it. But the reason that nuclear power can fill this huge gap that we have to get rid of fossil fuels worldwide is that it's so concentrated. The fuel for a plant like Three Mile Island for a year would fit on a truck. And if you do that with coal, it's going to take 25,000 rail cars full of coal. And then the waste stream is equally concentrated. The spent fuel from all of America's nuclear power for 60 years would fit inside a Walmart if you put it all in one place. And the coal waste, again, is thousands of times bigger, toxic, arsenic, mercury, lead. They last forever, like plutonium. And we just dispose of them in the most cavalier way, usually in poor communities. So the fact that it scales up so fast and that it's safe all have to do with how concentrated it is.
Evan, let me go back to you, and we, I'm sorry to say, don't have time to do justice to your book that you co-authored, Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster. We've been focusing largely on TMI because it's the 40th anniversary, and we are here in Pennsylvania. But looking at what happened at Fukushima, what lessons do you draw from that applied to nuclear energy?
Yes, well, unfortunately, a lot of the lessons from Fukushima are the same lessons that should have been learned after Three Mile Island, and that is one of the concerns we express in our book. After Three Mile Island, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry had the opportunity to apply a more comprehensive approach to nuclear safety that also address accidents or potential initiators like a complete loss of electrical power, like extreme flooding. These are the events that led all those decades later to Fukushima, and we saw, unfortunately, a lot of the same fundamental issues, the inability of operators to cope with situations they didn't understand, the control room, the inability to really know what was going on in the plant because the control room indicators were not giving the right information, and eventually that it can't happen here attitude, which led to the triple meltdowns at Fukushima, leading to massive release of radiation, the evacuation of 160,000 people, and potential financial consequences that are now estimated to exceed $200 billion. That's an externality of nuclear power that is not currently valued appropriately in its price, as, for instance, the carbon externality for fossil fuels.
Joshua Goldstein, can training, can attitude, is that fixable so that people who are working at a nuclear power plant know what they're doing?
Well, the systems can always be improved, but Tom Ferrick had it exactly right when he said you're always going to have risk with nuclear power, but you always have risk with everything, all the other energy sources for sure. And if you try to regulate to zero risk, you wouldn't be able to drive a car, fly in a plane, go in a building. You know, there's always risks, and you have to calculate. Now we have 60 years of record. Fukushima happened in the context of a huge earthquake a 50-foot tsunami, and it killed 18,000 people and wiped out large amounts of infrastructure. It also damaged a nuclear power plant at Fukushima. But what people, a lot of people don't know is that the radiation that escaped from Fukushima and affected the general public was never above the safety levels that we set for medical or industrial exposure to radiation. I've heard Ed Lyman on national TV say, quote, there's no safe dose of radiation. And that's just not true. We walk around in background radiation all the time. It varies. That's why we have these occupational limits. We never exceeded those limits. Nobody died from the radiation in Fukushima. And so, if anything, this showed that nature threw its worst, most catastrophic scenario. 18,000 people killed from that. Nobody killed from the nuclear power plant. And then, because of this overreaction and fear, they shut down all their nuclear plants, most of which are still offline, and started burning coal instead, which is killing people from emphysema and lung cancer.
Go ahead, Ed Lyman. I'm sure you want to respond.
Yes, and in fact, it's this kind of attitude. I think it's the wrong strategy for the nuclear advocates to try to, again, underplay the health and human consequences of accidents like Fukushima. First of all, Professor Goldstein is way off base. There wasn't sufficient documentation. People still don't know about the level of exposure for many of the people who were either evacuated or didn't evacuate after Fukushima. In fact, the evacuation planning was so haphazard that many people were brought into the path of the plume inadvertently, and there were communities many miles away from the plant that were not evacuated that should have been evacuated. So there are certainly significant exposures in the current estimate of the population dose from Fukushima that was derived by the UN would likely lead to probably thousands of cancer deaths over time. And in fact, some of the areas that have been contaminated they're not being decontaminated to the standard, the internationally accepted standard for background radiation exposure, but many times that standard, because the logic is you can't clean it up to where it was before, but it's still safe. But the consequences of that could be significant. So I would not underplay that.
Let me read a couple more comments here. One from Janet said, I believe that nuclear power is a grave threat. Just imagine if the meltdown had continued. This is referring to TMI. I feel that as long as there is an opportunity for human error, it will always be too dangerous to consider, and nuclear energy should not be an option. Let me also read, nuclear proponents really speak to decommissioning risks and costs. Even the safest plant will require decommissioning. And then an email from Bill who says, nuclear power will never be safe unless we figure out how to handle the waste. And I wonder, Joshua Goldstein, if you could refer to that. You mentioned the waste from nuclear energy, but I want to speak about what do we do with that stuff?
It's a very small volume, and right now we take it in when it comes out of the reactor and put it in cooling pools of water because the radiation doesn't go through water. We let it cool down for a couple of years, and then we put it in steel canisters inside concrete casks, about 18, 19 feet high cylinders, and they sit on concrete pads behind the plant. Edwin Lyman will probably tell you all kinds of scenarios of horrible things that could happen, but so far the fact is that they've never leaked. We've never had a problem with them. They're certified safe for many decades. And I've stood right next to them. The radiation doesn't leak out. You don't need any special gear. And then eventually, we'll either take those and bury them deep underground, which is a fine option. That's what Finland is doing. Or we'll take them and burn them for fuel in new reactors that are now being designed that can use the energy in our spent fuel to produce more electricity in future decades.
Edwin Lyman, you want to speak to the waste issue?
Yeah, first of all, Professor Goldstein's wrong about one important thing. He said that all spent fuel, or implied that all spent fuel, is moved from the wet storage pools to dry casks after a couple of years. That actually is not true. There's no current requirement that the spent fuel be moved out of the pools unless it exceeds the capacity of the pools. Now, the pools in this country are densely packed, partly because we do not have a permanent disposal site for spent fuel. And those densely packed spent fuel pools are a threat. In fact, my colleagues at Princeton University conducted a study where they evaluated if there were a spent fuel pool fire at the Peach Bottom plant, which is 60 miles from Pennsylvania, that that could not only trigger the need to relocate the entire population of Philadelphia, but also potentially Boston as well. You would have a dispersal of cesium-137 at a high concentration that would affect communities many hundreds of miles downwind. So I agree that spent fuel is safer when it's moved to dry cask, but the industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have refused to actually impose rules that would facilitate that.
We are getting two very different opinions about nuclear power, the risks, the rewards. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read an email from Nick. He says, if old nuclear plants get shut down today, they will be replaced by natural gas. Natural gas will lock in 50-plus years of fossil fuel use, including outsized methane leaks throughout the system. Let me just give each of you a chance to respond to that. Joshua Goldstein, first to you, and then to you, Edwin Lyman.
Yes, the methane, natural gas, does put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but it also leaks all along the line. And unburned methane is about 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas on the time scale we're concerned about from now to mid-century than carbon dioxide is. So it's a contributor to the problem, not as bad as carbon dioxide itself, but definitely a flaw in turning to natural gas, which is not clean the way the industry might would like you to think.
How do you see natural gas, Edwin Lyman?
Well, I would dispute the proposition that any nuclear plant shutting down would automatically be replaced with natural gas. As I said,
what would be the what would be other options?
Well, it depends on the region and the demand, and actually whether or not that nuclear plant was providing baseload capacity or reserve. So there are parts of the country where where a shutdown nuclear plant may not be replaced by a natural gas plant. In the UCS report that the professor referred to, we do think one of the criteria for a state providing support to keep a nuclear plant open would be if it would clearly be replaced by natural gas capacity. But again, that is not always the case. And I would, you know, instead of talking in these absolutes, mm-hmm. if we want innovation is is creative thinking outside of the box for any problem to solve. So it's not just how to expand nuclear power, but how to reform the grid and other policies more efficiently to maximize greenhouse gas reduction while also ensuring health and safety and doing it economically. That takes innovation.
Can we do that, Joshua Goldstein?
It's a fact that every place nuclear power plants have been taken off, retired early, they've been replaced with natural gas or coal. That's what happened in Japan. That's what happened in Germany, happened in California, Massachusetts, here where I live. We've shut down Vermont Yankee plant, brought in gas. They're building huge gas pipelines from Pennsylvania up to Massachusetts right now because in 2 months we're shutting down our last nuclear power plant. So that's what happens. Nuclear power goes out and gas goes in. And every expert who's talked about the TMI shutdown says it'll be replaced with natural gas. You don't have the renewables or the hydroelectricity in Pennsylvania to fill that gap.
And we have lots of natural gas in the state. We have to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Joshua Goldstein, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. There's a website at brightfuturebook.com if people want to learn more about that.
And Edwin Lyman, thank you for joining us as well. Any website you want to promote?
Yes, well, learn more at ucsusa.org. And again, our book, Fukushima, the Story of Nuclear Disaster. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. And don't forget tonight at 11 on TV, 11 o'clock on TV 12, Meltdown at TMI 40 Years Later. I'm Marty Moscoane.